Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I put a spotlight on the talented women working in film. Today, I'm joined by the brilliant Isabella Orlando, a Canadian-Italian filmmaker, writer, and creative producer whose work blends storytelling, archaeology, and cultural memory in deeply poetic ways. In this episode, we're talking about her short film Topos, which explores the connection between land, identity, and heritage. It's a lyrical meditation on what it means to belong to a place and how stories can be passed through objects, myth, and the earth itself. Isabella and I dive into her creative inspirations, her fascination with ancient history, and how Topos invites us to think differently about roots and storytelling. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy today's conversation with Isabella Orlando.
Thank you so much for reaching out to me, Isabella, and sharing your important work with me. It feels incredibly poignant with what's going on in certain parts of the world right now. So it was really interesting to watch your beautiful short poetic documentary, Topos. So after looking at your website, you mentioned, you know, that you've got roots in heritage and craft and personal history. So I'm wondering if you can share a sort of defining moment or project that shaped your creative path and the journey that got you on the path that you're on today.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to talk and share and connect. And thank you also for rightly raising the kind of the themes that I guess are spread across the film that are really relevant to some of the very intense things happening on a kind of global stage right now. I do want to use the release of the film as an opportunity to talk more about that. So I'm really grateful that you brought that up. And thank you also for diving into my work. It's always so nice to hear that people have kind of looked at my whole body of work as one piece, because I think it's really felt like one continuous thread has carried me through all of it. Like, it does feel very cohesive for me. And so I guess on that, it wasn't really one particular project that was a jumping off point into this way of working or into working around the theme of roots and heritage and where we come from. It's really kind of built up and feels like it's kind of all coming from the same source or the same seeds of interest. So I studied archaeology initially, and that was my first sort of foray into exploring where we come from and, you know, where we're going based on that. But that's really grown and changed so much over the years into storytelling around the process of how things come to be. So that's where craft kind of comes into it. And that's a big part of my practice, and then personal history and the psychological lens, the creative process, and now this sort of question of ancestry and landscape has kind of come onto the scene.
So, I mean, you yourself, you're of Canadian, Italian background and heritage. And as you said, you studied with archaeology, mythology, classics in London before then going to Oxford. So I'm wondering how these sort of cultural and academic journeys have influenced your own sort of focus on your work. And you live in London now. So what has that experience brought to your own personal work?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't gone in that direction from the get-go. To be honest, I feel like my instinct as a young person was to look back and to look at where, I guess it was where subconsciously where my family had come from, because even my studies in archaeology, I didn't really look at Britain, I looked at the Mediterranean. And so I was really interested, I think, in piecing together this very long history of this place that I always felt very connected to. But at the same time, there was a detachment. Having grown up in Canada, I always felt like a disconnection that was simultaneous with the connection, a sense that I didn't necessarily have a right to say I was Italian, or I didn't necessarily have a right to feel the connection that I did feel when I would go to the place where my grandmother was raised, or the country where all four of my grandparents come from. And so I think trying to plug that gap with learning and with knowledge and with education was sort of my first stab at that, trying to come up with that wholeness, like feel that wholeness and create a fuller picture for myself and almost refill in the gaps in my family's history, let's say. But I mean, I think overall the practice of archaeology, and I write about this on my Substack, which is actually called Archaeology for Poets. The process of doing archaeology is about digging and sifting and piecing together a story and trying to figure out what's plausible and having to have some degree of imagination, because as they say, the past is a foreign country. We don't actually know what happened before for us, and we have to imagine. At the same time, with those things that we do know, I was always interested as well in what's been lost over the years and what people remember and how is that different from what actually happened. And so there's all this subjectivity too. And I think that frame of mind really influences my work as an artist and as a filmmaker, because there is so much room for the subjective. And the process of storytelling isn't always linear, And I think also with this particular film and with a lot of the work that I love, playing with time, like time is not linear in the film and it's not linear in many of the projects that I love. And I think when you stand on a piece of land that your family has worked for generations, you can really feel that you're not necessarily in the present and you're not necessarily in the past and you're somewhere in between. So I think as a way of thinking, it really influenced me and continues to influence me. And then, of course, aesthetically, there is such a pull, I think, for me for not necessarily the glory of the past in its glory, but something decrepit, something that's degraded, something that's changed over time, something that's been re-inhabited and reused and changed and maybe lessened in its quality, I guess, over time, but still carries that memory. That's something that's always spoken to me and I'm very drawn to visually. And so that's another, I guess, key piece of that influence.
Especially, I think it's since, I mean, at least for me, I think that the world is going in such a digital direction with AI and everything. It feels like you've really got on to all this history because for fear of losing it in a way or it disappearing. So yeah, it's important work to do for sure. Was there a particular artist or film or filmmaker that made you feel that you could do this too and this is how you wanted to express your work? And has your relationship with that inspiration sort of evolved over time?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think absolutely. And I feel like I'm finding those new inspirations all the time. Alice Rohrwacher, her work is so influential for me. I think she comes from rural Tuscany and the way she speaks as well about that landscape and how growing up there and the dilemmas that she faced in her relationship with the past. When I first started listening to her give interviews, which actually ironically was very tied to my journey with my cultural identity, given that I had to learn Italian to be able to, well, I learned Italian independently. And then after learning Italian, was actually able to listen to her interview and listen to her speak. And so interestingly, that path was very entwined. But all to say, Alice Rohrwacher's work has always really spoken to me in terms of its intention and also visually. I also really, really love the work of the early work, I guess, of Luca Guadagnino. Like, I think some of the Italian aesthetics of Call Me By Your Name and the presence of archaeology in those films. I think that really spoke to me as an archaeology student when it first came out, like seeing archaeology used as a device to tell the story of how we see ourselves, how we see the past, the bits of ourselves we want to, you know, betray and expose, and the bits of ourselves that we want to forget through this motif of this statue being lugged out of the lake. It was very powerful for me. But I guess today, I mean, I just saw a film on Friday that I think will be really influential for my future work. And so I feel like I'm always developing and adding to that body of work. And this was When the Phone Rang by Eva Radivojek. I have to check her surname, but she's a brilliant independent filmmaker of, I think, Serbian background that made this incredibly poetic narrative feature based around memory in her own life. And I think seeing projects like that really push the boundaries of narrative and fiction and nonfiction and playing with time and playing with perspective and also very much situating you in a place. Place is really important to me. I find that to be really inspirational. But that's just film. I mean, I think I'm really influenced as well by art and by music. So any projects that are really anchored in place really speak to me. Photography as well. I'm really inspired by photography as a filmmaker in terms of framing, in terms of, I mean, a lot of my shots are very static. So I think photography, you can kind of sense the influence of photography in that way. And definitely music that in a sort of non-fussy way can talk about place or can talk about memory. I think sometimes poetry can feel very literary and it makes sense to be that way when its final destination is to live on the page. But when you're making something for screen, it's really different. And so I really like music for that because it's designed to be heard and to be understood through the process of actually absorbing it through hearing, not reading.
It's interesting that you mentioned both Alice Rohrwacher and Luca Guadagnino. Obviously, they're both very prominent Italian filmmakers. And after watching your short film, the first film that came to mind after also reading about your, you know, your work was La Chimera, which I haven't actually seen, but from what I've read about it, and I'm dying to see it when I get the chance. But that's definitely what came to mind straight away for me, because I know that that film explores really deeply the past and archaeology and, yeah, and her own heritage in Italy. So yeah, I can definitely see that connection straight straight away.
Thank you. That's such a compliment. And it's funny, I actually watched La Chimera after I shot this. So it was really validating. Like, that was definitely a moment where I felt very validated in my sense of, you know, my style. It's really slow. It's really like the pace of the film is really slow. The shots are really static. And I felt at times like I wasn't making cinema because it was so simple. But actually to see other people do that and for it to be celebrated is so cool to see.
Yeah, I went to one of her masterclasses when I went to Cannes a couple of years ago, and she was so interesting. But I thought she spoke English, but maybe not. I think there was a translator there. There must have been.
I think she does, but she prefers. From what I understand, maybe she prefers Italian. She gave a talk at the BFI a few months ago that I unfortunately couldn't see, but there was a translator there, and I feel very blessed. I can hear her speak in her native tongue because she's so eloquent.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you're gonna be able to express yourself in a way that you can't. Like, you can express yourself in your own native language in a way that you can't in another. It's, you know, it's not the same, I guess. So do you see, you know, after your studies, do you see women's stories and ancient narratives sort of mirroring the silences or the struggles that women are facing today, whether that be in cinema or in art or in general sense?
That's such a good question. I'm so glad you asked that, because I haven't spoken about that with regard to this project, but I have actually written about this. I wrote an article for Breathe magazine, I think it was a year and a half ago, about this. Like, I was curious because I feel like there's been a real uptake of rewriting mythology in like fiction literature, that women writers are rewriting these stories where the female characters, because a lot of ancient Greek mythology at least is quite patriarchal, like it still follows into a lot of those tropes that we continue to see in storytelling today. There's a brilliant book, if anyone's interested in this, really short, by Mary Beard, who's a very renowned classicist, is a public figure, a little bit dicey, but has done a lot in the discipline in terms of like academic contribution, but wrote a very short, very accessible public book called Women in Power. And it just kind of breaks down how ancient a lot of these ideas about women and about power are. And a lot of them come back to kind of ancient Greek tropes and stories. And so that's really fascinating as a place to go if you're kind of looking for, I guess, a resource. And I heard her speak on that when the book came out. And yeah, that was really, I remember that being very powerful. I do think that there is this uptake, because I do think we are, as a generation of women in the West, I should say, we have an opportunity now that we haven't had forever, potentially, or for many, 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 many centuries, to start reclaiming some of these narratives. And so I think there's a lot of energy in that space to rewrite these historical stories with more agency. That said, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think I stress also that our experience in this part of the world is not mirrored everywhere. And so we are very privileged in a way that a lot of women around the world are not. And equally, there is so much we can learn from other parts of the world and how women own their positions in society in different ways, in different cultures. So a bit of a roundabout way of saying, like, I think it is really important. It's not something that I've worked on extensively, like retelling a female story, but I do think my lens is very feminine. Like, I see things as relational. I see things as connected. I see things as tied. And I think also with this particular project, there's an underlying, I guess, experience of a connection to my mother and her mother and my father's mother that all come from this region, that all come from this land. Funnily enough, my grandfathers actually come from different parts of Italy, not Calabria, where this film was shot. And so it's really, when I think about that, I think this is really my mother line that I'm exploring here. And equally, I think the experiences of grief and loss of all of those women in my life, like, has deeply influenced the film. And so there's this, I think it awakens this sort of sensitivity and this raw nerve that really heightens your ability to feel those connections and to feel that relationality in a way that maybe you don't access until later in life, and that I think maybe is a feminine characteristic. Not to say that men can't have it, but I think there's something about seeing how things are connected that feels very feminine to me.
Yeah, sort of looking back on the, yeah, as you say, the sort of mother line, the connection to your home and your heritage. So you say that Topos is described as a sort of poetic documentary. And as you say, it centres on the women's identity, your identity in particular, in relationship to sort of land and place, in particular to Calabria.
Oh, that's right.
So yeah, can you walk me through the sort of origins of the film and what really sparked the initial idea, even though you've sort of gone over it a bit there, but if you could sort of go over it a bit more in detail.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's worth mentioning, and I think I've said this a few times now as I've had conversations around the film throughout its release, I didn't actually intend really on making this film. I was in Crete, which is not the south of Italy, as we know, it's Greece. But there was a real similarity in the way that I felt in the landscape there. I felt very held by it. It's very majestic. It's very rugged. It's very pronounced. The mountains are big. The sea is vast. It's very dramatic. And so I think being in that landscape, driving in that landscape, feeling like you could see across the valley at the other mountains that were kind of around that were kind of around us and like encircling us felt very, yeah, it felt like a cradle. And so I wanted to really capture that. And so I kind of just followed my nose with that. I happened to have my camera with me. I often bring my camera with me and don't shoot anything. I just bring it so that if I have this feeling, I can capitalize on it and I can take advantage of it. And so I did have that feeling that I wanted to capture this experience. At the same time, because I guess of that sense of feeling so held, and I had taken a holiday and I hadn't taken a holiday in ages, and I was really alone with my thoughts. And with a good friend, and we were having lots of really good conversations during that time. I was really thinking about, well, why do I feel this connection to this place? And what I know so much about the history of this place because of my studies. Is that the reason that I feel connected to it? And then I thought, well, I've been to many places that I've studied and I've not felt this way. So what could it be? And then I remembered that the ancient Greeks from the islands moved to the south of Italy in, I forgot what year it is. It's like a few hundred years BC. So there's this like ancestral link if you go back and back and back and back. And I do think it's a bit dangerous politically and kind of natural nationalistically to think about genealogy in that way. Like, oh, well, we originally come from here, and therefore we have a right to this land. That's not what I'm saying at all. I just felt this sense of connection to the landscape. And so I really dove into that. And my way of processing and exploring ideas is writing. I always will write as a first port of call just to sift through the different things that are happening up in my head and in the conversations that I'm having. And so what came out was was kind of a semi-poem, but I always imagined it with the visuals I had shot in Crete. Like I imagined that they lived in the same world for me. And those words were not complete, I think, without the visuals as well. Like when I write a poem for poetry's sake, it's very different. It's a very different output. Whereas this was a lot simpler. It was a lot more kind of threadbare, but I thought together with the images that told the story that I was trying to tell. And as I started to put my finger on this ancestral connection, I started to remember more about the things I had studied. And one of those things was this concept of topos, which is the title of the film, but it means place in Greek. But there's an ancient Greek concept that I studied many years ago, which basically says that the topography is not just a physical topography. It also has a spiritual layer or an ancestral layer or a layer of memory. So you know that gods resided in specific places and people when they were alive inhabited certain spaces, and that when they died they would be buried in certain places, and those were all marked in the landscape. And so I was thinking a lot about that and how the landscape holds these memories and how the body also can hold memory potentially of being in a place generations ago, because I mean we're all made of the same stuff really. So it really kind of snowballed from there. And then once the poetic kind of script had been written and I could kind of see it in my mind's eye and I was playing around with editing what I had, I decided I would go back to Italy and shoot the rest of the film there, which is actually where my ancestry does connect more recently. And so that's where it kind of became more of a proper production. And I was out there with the intention of filming, and I filmed and edited actually the first version right there at the table, looking over the sea view that you see in a lot of the shots. Like I pieced a lot of the project together on that trip and then kind of fine-tuned it when I came back with a lovely small team that really held my vision very, very gently and very respectfully and really brought their magical touches to it. And I think a lot of that collaboration is what's kind of made the project really sing. Like the music and the sound and the color are my favorite things about it. And they're all the things I didn't do. So yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Definitely, because I was going to mention myself that, yeah, the word topos means place in Greek. So it's interesting that you've actually used a Greek word as opposed to an Italian one. But after you explaining, how it all unfolded, it makes a lot of sense why you chose that as the name for the film. And also another work comes to mind when you talk about, a body sort of registering that having been in places like The Body Keeps the Score, that book. I haven't read it either, but I have heard of it. And it's an interesting sort of thing to think about, where almost like your body knows that it's connects somewhere, but you might not know why initially. But when you dig deeper, like you have, you can realize why you feel a connection to somewhere or someplace.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there are these emerging bodies of research that speak to this. Like there's an emerging body of research in epigenetics, which is this idea that like things like fear can be passed on in our DNA, or I guess as a response to a threat, the idea that the body would want to pass that information on to the next generation for survival reasons. It makes perfect sense when you think about sort of evolution. But like, these are emerging kind of scientific ways of exploring this same thing. And I think the format, I could have gone that way. Like, I think an older version of myself would have felt the need to find an expert to explain why it was that I felt the way that I felt. And with this project, I really wanted to push the boat out and not make a traditional documentary and not feel that someone more expert than me needed to validate that, and instead just share the experience in all of its rawness. And actually, the response has been incredible because so many of the people who have seen it have shared their personal versions of a story like this or of a feeling like this. And so I think that felt more important to me, which is why I opted for this poetic format rather than a more traditional doc.
Yeah, something that feels more universal and reachable to everyone, because it is personal to your experience, but I think it can be felt by everyone because you're not going so deeply personal into your own experience and story in a way that, yeah, it might be less relatable to others in some ways, but yeah, it feels like a universal sort of story and experience. It also explores, you know, the link between femininity and nature, and I'm wondering how you worked to sort of avoid this cliche of like maybe woman is earth or mother earth sort of maybe trope, but still honoring that connection, because you know you feature a lot of water, rocks, you know, the landscapes. So yeah, how did you go about honoring that connection?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I mean the easy answer is I didn't really feel a sense of like that Mother Earth idea did not come naturally when I was coming up with the script or when I was putting the edit together. It's good to hear that I've successfully dodged that sort of cliche, because I do feel like, I don't know, I think it does feel really true for certain projects. And I didn't really feel like this was about motherhood or about creativity in that way of like birthing new life. I think this was more about personal history and more about looking at roots, and those roots don't just have to come from the mother, they can come from the father. And I think my father is also a key piece in the story. I mean, it's his mother who I feel this strong connection to with that land, because that's exactly where she was brought up. And my dad has actually returned to that land and now spends a lot of his time there. And so there's been this kind of full circle within the family that I think also got me thinking about these ideas and themes. So I think having it spread out across like mother and father figures within my own family definitely helped to kind of look at it in a more holistic, neutral way. I also think, I mean, as a plea to change the way we engage with the planet, I think this film is not. Like, I think it's more of an exploration of this personal connection. And I think that personal connection gives way to a sense of caregiving and a sense of safeguarding and stewardship over landscape, over land, over earth. But I think it has to come from that place rather than almost the scolding mother that's saying, well, you should care and you should be doing more. And I just don't know that that's really successful. And if it is, I don't think it's my work to do that kind of work, at least not at this stage in my career. I feel I've always been more interested in those cultural aspects and how that interacts with the land and landscape and place, rather than this kind of inherent responsibility that we do have. I do believe that we have that, but there's a reason that we're divorced from that. And that's because we live way, way disproportionately in cities, like more than ever before. And I think we have a divorced connection to the land that we spend our time in, whether it's ancestral or not. And so it was more for me about eliciting that feeling, because I think that has dividends to pay tenfold, you know, not just in terms of our relationship with the planet, but in terms of our relationship with ourselves, our communities, our families, our lifestyles, like how well we are, how we eat, how we live our lives day to day. You know, I think there's a lot of wisdom to be gleaned in these sort of ancestral ways of living that really only recently in terms of human history have been semi-abandoned or are on the decline. And I don't think it's an easier way of life. I think it's a lot harder. The stakes are a lot higher and requires a different kind of hard work than I think what we're used to. But that said, I think there's a lot of wisdom that's been built up in that way of thinking and living over the generations that I think it would be a shame to abandon. And I think that's part of the reason maybe that the world feels like it's moving backwards, because we're not building, I think, on the wisdom that not everyone is. And certainly it feels like the powers that be are not, you know.
I mean, it's interesting sort of that your film has come into my life at the same time as I've just watched another film by another director called Jesse Gooch called Blue Has No Borders. And on almost, I mean, not the same kind of discussion, but similar aspects, really. You know, she's exploring the immigrant experience from the town she's living in called Folkestone in the UK, and how the sort of water separates, you know, Folkestone from France, yet it also connects us in a way, but also discussing with the people in the film, the people of Folkestone who have been there, you know, their whole life and want to honour like the history and the legacy of the town and the fishermen and everything that's come before it, while almost struggling to embrace this new side where immigrants are coming over. And yeah, there seems to be like that sort of, I guess it's maybe some sort of power balance in a way, like they want to honour the history, they don't want it to be forgotten, and they're scared of this new future that's coming in a way. But yeah, I know what you mean about the whole sort of going backwards. I think it's trying to find a balance in some way between the two.
Absolutely. It's like building on that knowledge, because I don't think that it's useful necessarily. Like this idea of preservation of the past was something I always felt really opposed to, even as an archaeologist. Like I didn't feel like the past needed to be revered and like stuck behind glass and yeah, remaining in its kind of former glory. I think that's kind of a dangerous concept actually, because again, the past is a foreign country. We don't actually know. And there are a lot of things about history that are completely not aligned with maybe where we want the world to go. I mean, if we're talking, we were talking recently about women, like we can't totally revert, but I think there are these ways of thinking. And I think also the smaller you go, as in smaller communities away from, I guess, seats of power, have these much more kind of universal concepts that are really similar, I think, across cultures about how to live in harmony with nature, about how to live in community. And we now are in a position where we can choose what we want to take and what we want to leave, you know? But I think that departure from a landscape perspective, from living in nature, living a life that was actively connected to nature as well, like agricultural society, being so dependent on it. I think it is kind of traumatic, to be honest, to then basically live in boxes in cities that are paved and have a tree every 5 meters or whatever. You know, I think it's like for the body, like as we say, the body remembers, and like as animals, this is not our natural habitat. And so I think there is this sense of disconnection that people are feeling. And this is what I mean when I say it's a more holistic conversation, because I think this also feeds into the loneliness epidemic and the mental health epidemic. Like I think all these things are connected. And so I don't propose that I have this single solution, but I guess this is more a sliver of maybe what we might be missing through my own experience and through the experiences of people that I've met through releasing the film.
Definitely. I mean, I've recently moved to a city not as big as London, but yeah, I'm always seeking out the green spaces because it's so important. I mean, I know there's great parks in London and spaces of nature that are not too far, or even just the Thames, even though it's probably not the cleanest waters, but you know, it's a connection. You've got to find that connection back to the earth in some way, whether that's a park or water or greenery. It's your body asks for it, I think. You know, I think it's rare that it doesn't, even if you do like the city life.
100%.
The next question I want to ask was on a sort of different note, but how important was sound for you in crafting the atmosphere of Topos? I mean, you said a little bit about it before, but yeah, did you use sort of natural soundscapes or did you compose anything at all? I mean, I think for me, mostly what I heard was natural soundscapes, whether that was waves or, can you explain more about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think the sound is a really key sort of storytelling device in the project. And for me, it's really the first time I was really obsessed with sound on a project. I think I am so much more visual. And so in the past, I think I've prioritized that. But actually with this project, sound was such a key piece and is a key piece in filmmaking and is something I've come to appreciate so much over the last few years. But yeah, so it is all natural sound that was recorded on location by myself. So I recorded all of the sound as well as did all of the cinematography. And basically there are a few kind of key components in the sound design that come in at kind of specific points. So as an overall composition, it's very considered. And the sound designer, Jake Dufton, did such a brilliant job of that. So the kind of crickets come in at a specific point and then they come out and then they come in again at the end. And then the wind comes in at a specific point and the wind comes out at the end. And really, I see both of those things as an extension of the very beginning of the film, which is a sort of whispered poem, which is written in, I believe it's the second person when you refer to you. And that is supposed to be kind of the voice of the land itself. And so that is carried through the poem and the film through the sound. So that presence of something else, that other layer of the topography, as per the title, is animated through the wind and the bugs and the waves and the whistle. Yeah, it's all kind of part of that. And then the music was composed for the film, and that was composed with the poem already devised. And so the pacing of them is kind of married and connected and linked. And the music I really love as well. And Jake did that too, and couldn't have asked for better. I was so pleased with the music.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. This definitely adds to the whole overall atmosphere and experience of feeling like you're really, yeah, immersed in the nature yourself and the land that you're talking about. So I'd like to talk more a little bit about your other sort of projects that you're involved in, from your mentorships to your own studio. And for your mentorships, which is, you know, to sort of craft your creative life, what sort of common blocks do these participants face in this mentorship, and how do you help them realign with their sort of creative purpose?
Yeah, so the mentorship was something I ran last summer. So it was about a year ago they did this, and I did it again over the winter, and I haven't actually got any plans to do it in the future yet, but it's something that might come back into my life. We'll see. I think that really came from a place of growing up in a community that is a bit more traditional in terms of career path, in terms of what it is that you kind of are expected to do versus what you are maybe called to do. Those things don't necessarily always line up. A very tight-knit community, which can have its pros and have its cons, as many people know, you know, it feels like, you know, that you're always being observed at times, or that there are these kind of conventions that you're expected to respect and these expectations. And so I really devised the mentorship and the kind of workshop series to invite a lot of those conversations around why we might feel it's difficult to lean into our creativity, and why it is that we might feel that we can't, or that we're not allowed to. And so a lot of the participants kind of brought those sorts of blocks into the conversation in terms of what's expected of them. And it's interesting, a few of them come from my community of origin, so they could respond really directly to the same experiences that I had had and come through. And I'm still navigating, to be honest with you. I think these things are like lifelong lessons. But at the same time, there were other people who came from other disciplines. Like one was an academic, another was in a very corporate path. Yeah, just people in different kind of constrictive self designed in many cases career paths or lifestyles that were trying to break out of these boxes that they had kind of created for themselves. And all we really did was work through, I shared a little bit about my process of kind of making a project come to life and all of the things that I've learned from all the reading I've done and all of the trial and error I've been through to try to make space for creativity in my life. And I basically just opened the doors to show people about like my process of that and how that had developed, and made that really collaborative. So there were lots of touch points and calls and kind of co-working and co-sharing sessions. And yeah, and I think the idea and the intention was just to help people to reconnect with that part of themselves that has always wanted to be creative and has an idea and actually does already know where they're going, but maybe has some layers in the way of things that have been kind of put on them or that they've put onto themselves that they can actually kind of shed. So more about that process. But interestingly, I feel like after, like the first group was so powerful. It was such a synergistic group of people that really got along well and understood what the program was there to do. And then I had a second group, which was a bit smaller, that was also really wonderful to work with those people. But it kind of felt like it lost steam, I guess, for me, in terms of I felt like I was bursting at the seams a year ago to share this information. And a year on, I can't say that I'm still in that place. And so I think it's utilizing all those things that I was teaching, which is like letting yourself give up when something is really not working for you anymore. You know, I think that was it. I felt this sense of like, my work here is done for now. Like these are the people. I really believe that a project comes through us when it's needed by something else or someone else in the world. And I felt like that definitely happened with the mentorship, where I ran it for a season and I felt like the people that needed it received it. And then I didn't feel the need to do any more than that. It felt like my work was done.
I mean, you're also part of, or were part of, the Google Arts and Cultures Heritage sort of preservation team, working with UNESCO and museums. Is there any project that stands out to you most? And can you tell me what it taught you about storytelling and cultural preservation?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a kind of stint that I did after my master's in archaeology. And so, yeah, I mean, so this was something I had been studying way before that work. I basically had done my master's thesis on communication and the importance of communication. And I think the thing that all of these things that I've talked about in my practice, how formative archaeology and an understanding of the past was, and the just a recognition of how layered these stories are, and the idea that the stories that we observe and absorb and contribute to in film and television and books and in all these different spheres today, like that they come from something else, and that they're all evolutions of similar things that have existed for generations and for centuries. I wanted to share that. Like, I wanted to explore how more people could be made aware of those connections, because I think that's the problem with archaeology or with any academic discipline, really. It can be very siloed. It can be very in the ivory tower. And so I felt very much that I also knew, I guess, that I didn't want to be somebody that worked on the facts. I think I figured that out really quickly. Like, I'm not actually interested that much in what happened for real. I'm definitely interested in what people think happened. I'm definitely interested in how the memory, whether correct or incorrect, of what happened influences culture now. And so I think that was what really guided my studies and the work I was putting out at that time. It was mostly writing. I was writing a lot about these ideas in travel in different cities and different countries that I had visited, and how their heritage was influencing their culture. And so that was what landed me that job. And yeah, and I think from working on like a producer level, I basically realized I felt very divorced from the creative work itself. Like, that was huge for me in terms of pivoting into becoming a filmmaker and really leaning into that and making that my full-time work. And so, yeah, I mean, it was fantastic. I got to work with some incredible organizations on some incredible sites around the world. And I think it just showed me like how much richness there is in these places that have such a history, but also in the who is doing the storytelling. So we sometimes look to these institutions to give us like the correct information or the vetted information because it feels more, I guess, reliable. But I learned so much from the communities that work on those sites or live their lives beside those sites day to day. And that became my question. So when I then went on to work with heritage organizations, like I've worked with World Monuments Fund, I've worked with other heritage bodies in my freelance practice, like those were the first people that we ended up interviewing when I then made documentaries for those organizations. We ended up looking to the communities and the lived experience of living a life, I don't know, in the shadow of Angkor Wat, and what that's like, you know. So it just changed the way that I approach who you ask, I guess, about these sites, because I do think it's the communities that give them so much meaning and that carry a lot of those more anecdotal histories that feel way more animated than in whatever year so-and-so did this. Like, I think it's about heart. It's about that personal connection for me. And so finding people that had skin in the game, that really cared because it was generational or it was ancestral or it touched on something that they themselves were really invested in, that always feels a lot more alive. There are so many good examples of this. Like, I think Charlie Cooper's Myth Country is such a good program and so invested in such a similar theme of like speaking to people who really, really care. It's a huge part of their identity. It's a huge part of how they spend their time, their hobbies, their work, whatever. And yet, you know, and that just animates a history that could be told in such a dry way in with so much more magic.
Yeah, they're like the true storytellers, really, because they're very much, as you say, within it or living beside it. And have really lived the experience compared to an organization that's sort of, as you say, sort of just stating the facts on a kind of maybe more surface level, it might feel like. And how do you feel, you know, now your role as a filmmaker is going to evolve as your projects become more sort of digitally distributed and, you know, reaching more of a global audience? How do you see your role changing? Are you envisioning feature length documentary with more of a in-depth narrative, perhaps? Yeah, well, how are you seeing your role evolve in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. And I think that's the fun of it. That's part of the magic of it. I feel like I definitely would like to make a feature at some point. I'm working on another short at the moment. I'm really enjoying shorts, I think, for the time being, because I feel like they're these little parcels, like they're these little pockets where you get to kind of explore a theme and go deep, but it's also accessible and you can put out more work, I guess, and you can explore more different things. But I do think I'm noticing definitely a slowing down in terms of my process. I think spending this much time on the Topos release, it's only really been a few months, but it's felt like a long time to me, I think has definitely felt like a bit of a revelation, like actually spending time in the world with the project, even after it's complete, feels really worthwhile. And so I definitely think just taking that approach forward is something I definitely want to do. I'm, like I said, I'm working on another short, so that's going to be something completely different, but definitely still in the sort of experimental space between, between nonfiction and kind of performative or experimental formats is something I'm really interested in, like really making documentaries that don't feel like documentaries, but that feel like La Chimera, you know what I mean? So imbuing them with a bit of that magic, I think, is something I definitely want to continue. And then I'm also writing a lot more, actually. So I'm back on Substack after a bit of a delay / pause. I'm writing essays around really similar themes to the ones we discussed. So you can find me there at Archaeology for Poets, just my name, the account's just under my name. And then potentially I'm working on a collection of poems as well. And so I'm not sure what the timeline will be like on releasing that, but it's in a kind of draft format that I've been kind of putting together for a long time and starting to reach completion stages with, I guess. So I guess eyes peeled for that. And some of those poems live in the same world as Topos. So I'm really excited about that as a body of work that might be coming soon. Yeah, lots of pots on the burner.
How do you think that the industry can better support the voices of, you know, women who are working and preserving cultural memory through cinema? Do you think it's supported well today, and or could it do better?
I mean, I think it's easy to say it could do better. I think that speaks to a much wider problem in our culture, in that we don't value art in the same way that we value like a technological advancement and by value, I mean putting money where our mouth is. And I think the really interesting thing is that so many of the people that do well in other industries, they use their wealth and their success to spend time absorbing art, like to go to the theater, to go to concerts, to travel, to read, to have time to absorb all of these things that we're making. And so I just think that cultural shift feels so much bigger than saying, you know, there need to be more grants, or there needs to be more this, or there needs to be more that. But that said, I mean, looking at the bigger picture can sometimes feel really insurmountable. So I think there could be better connectivity, I guess, between the cultural sector and film. And I wouldn't even consider myself like somebody who's in the film industry. I feel like I'm very much on the fringe. I do think something that the film industry could maybe be better at acknowledging as real films are these smaller projects where one person is doing a lot of the roles. I think film as an industry can still be very traditional in the sense of, you know, everybody wears their specific hat and the crew is this size and everybody is doing these very like structured jobs in these very structured departments. And that there's a time and place for that. I think if you're making like a Marvel film, there's no other way potentially to approach a project like that than to have a really organized team. That said, I do think for independent cinema, for these more personal projects, for projects that brush with culture, which is also a field that's very underfunded and that is really struggling to kind of stay on its feet, we need to be scrappier than that. And so I think investing in filmmakers who are more like filmmakers in the round, that do a lot of the things and wear a lot of the hats and can be more independent or a smaller scale with their projects, that feels, I think, like a natural fit. And I think it also feels like where the world is going in terms of the creation of content and just the shift that we're seeing in terms of these like individuals that can make really powerful stories come to life. Like, I think that that's a really natural marriage between the culture sector and film and video content, let's say. So yeah, I mean, partnerships, I think, would be wonderful. But I think also there's a lot of risk and onus on artists. Like, we're always the one filling in applications. We're always the ones pitching. We're always the ones having to invest time to develop the concept before we actually get paid or are hired or are confirmed. Like, you know, we have to almost do the work first and then reap the rewards. And I don't really know how to shift that, I guess, apart from partnership and apart from, I do think there's a time and place also for bartering. So like, you know, if cultural organizations can cover expenses, like put you up somewhere so that you can spend the time making a project with them in a place, I think that would be fantastic. And I know there are some programs definitely in the UK, certainly abroad, that offer that. But I think more and more, I think especially privately owned like historic properties, I think there's a real crisis, especially in the UK, in terms of people not knowing how to manage these properties that have been inherited as well. And I just think getting really creative about publicizing them in a way that also offers support for artists that are doing that work I think could be a really interesting route forward. And I'd love to do some work in the UK. Having lived here for so many years, I feel like something exploring English identity is brewing, and Englishness and English folklore and history. And so, yeah.
Very interesting. Just sort of my sort of last few questions, rapid fire, kind of lightning round sort of style. Although we have already talked about some films that inspire you. And I usually like to ask guests, you know, their sort of top five films. You already have mentioned... Well, you've mentioned directors, I guess, but you've mentioned La Chimera and Call Me By Your Name. Would you like to add another three to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't even know that Call Me By Your Name is a favorite. It's a beautiful film and I do love it, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's a favorite. We can leave it on there for the vibes. I would actually say The Wonders by Alice Rohrwacher is my preferred film of hers. I love La Chimera, but I love The Wonders as well. So let's add that one. Arrival by Denis Villeneuve is my absolute favorite.
Great film.
Great film about communication, yeah, about what it means to be human. Also plays with that like time sliding scale in such a beautiful way. Love that film. And I think, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think it's got to be Dune. I really love Dune. There's something that feels really cultural about it. Like it feels like a mythology of the world as it is. And I think the different like tribes and I guess sort of like ethnic or religious connotations that some of those groups of people have, it's such an interestingly like political and cultural sci-fi film.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the, or the, if not the best sci-fi of our generation, I think.
I agree. I completely agree. I really want to read the book, but I think also in terms of filmmaking, like
it's
sound, music, all those things we discussed, they absolutely smashed it out of the park. And Denis Villeneuve is Canadian, so I've chosen all Canadians and Italians for my list.
And do you have a sort of favorite creative ritual or a daily habit that kind of keeps you grounded in your work? I mean, I guess your creative work itself is probably a creative ritual and a daily habit for, you know, writing and filmmaking. But is there anything else outside of that you do, yeah, that keeps you sane?
Yeah, I write every single day. I think that's the thing that is really my linchpin. Like I wake up in the morning. I used to just make a cup of coffee like first thing. And actually, I've tried to shift that recently because the addiction is just
too strong.
Yeah, but I still will sit down and I write, even if it's for 5 minutes. I just kind of free flow right through everything that's on my mind. I kind of wake up with a bit of an active brain. And so it's a good way to kind of almost wake up a second time and reset. The morning pages were super formative from the artist's way. So that's really stuck with me. Yeah, I think that's my main thing. And then I think, as we've said it, it would be wrong not to say like just time in nature. Like when I have more time, and as you say, even in London, like staring into the Thames for several minutes will do it for me. Like that's fine. So just those moments to daydream and disconnect from the noise, but reconnect like physically and just get kind of grounded or just priceless.
They're priceless. Or look at a tree or the sky. Every day. Well, I think that's all my questions, really, and you've answered everything that I wanted to know. So thank you so much for speaking with me today, Isabella. It's been really interesting and enlightening, and now I need to go and watch La Chimera and all of Alice Rohrwacher's filmography, to be honest.
I do. You won't regret it. And thank you so much for having me and for your thoughtful questions and across my work. I mean, so cool to hear about, I guess to hear that you've dove in as a body of work rather than just the one project. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Isabella.
A huge thank you to Isabella for sharing her process and vision behind Topos. Her work is a beautiful reminder that film doesn't always need to explain. It can evoke, remember, and reconnect us with something older than language. If you're curious to see Topos for yourself or learn more about Isabella's storytelling work, check out the links in the show notes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share the Real Girls Club with someone who loves thoughtful, independent film made by women. Until next time, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.